This is the official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the official EFL podcast with me, Mark Clement. At the end of a week in which I'm sad to say we lost two Football League legends, Peter Lorimer and Frank Worthington. Meanwhile, a modern day hero chalked up a major landmark when the EFL's longest serving player, Dean Lewington, celebrated his 800th appearance for MK Dons by signing a new contract that will take him into his 18th season with the club. And it was business as usual in the fast-moving world of football management, with Danny Cowley, Nigel Adkins and Gary Bowyer all finding work, the latter at the expense of Richie Wellens at Salford City, just a week after he won the delayed 2020 Papa John's Trophy Final. It's the official EFL podcast. So after the latest round of fixtures in the Sky Bet Championship, Cardiff City came out on top after the second South Wales derby of the season. Barnsley's magnificent 12-match unbeaten run came to an end at the hands of Sheffield Wednesday, ending their sequence of just a point from their last eight games, and 1-1 in 9 has led to the departure of Alex Neil from Preston North End. Your Sky Bet Championship table as we head into the international break. The bottom three are Wickham, Sheffield Wednesday and Rotherham. Then there is a three-point gap to Birmingham, followed by Coventry and Derby from the bottom. At the top, Norwich lead the way. They are 8 points clear of second place Watford, who are 6 points clear of third place Swansea, and 7 clear of Brentford in fourth. Then come Barnsley and Reading. Then just outside the playoffs, Bournemouth, Cardiff and Middlesbrough, after which there is a 4-point gap to Cardiff City. At the top of the Sky Bet Championship scorers list, and fast closing in on Glenn Murray's divisional record of 30 for Crystal Palace in the 2012-13 season, is Brentford's Ivan Toney with 28. The last three courtesy of his now famous, well, I'll tell you what, Ivan, I'm calling it penalty pass technique. What do you describe it as? I'm mesmerised every time I see you step up to take it. How do you describe your technique?
Well, first and foremost, you have to be confident doing it. I think a lot of people and my family, I think I give them heart attacks when I step up to it. But yeah, you just got to be patient, really. As you said, it's just a pass. You got to wait for the keeper to make the move and then pass it into one of the corners.
And is the laid-back walk-up and seemingly not looking nervous, is that all part of the theatre and the act of lulling the keeper into a false sense of security and sending them the wrong way?
You could look at it like that, but it's just like if you got to walk up to the penalty knowing you're going to score and be confident. And you got, like I said, you got to wait for the keeper to make the move and then slot it and be patient and confident enough to wait for the keeper and pass it into the corner. So it's a difficult technique, but it's a good one as well if you want to be scoring goals.
Yeah. But so I want to be absolutely clear about this. As you start the run up and make, there is a little feint in there, is there? There is a little feint from you to try and send the keeper a certain way.
It's a little straw, just a little straw. Just nice and slow, stare at the keeper, let him make the move. When he makes the move, pass it in the other corner.
I thought against Forest, watching it back a few times, knowing I was going to touch you, I thought there was the slightest hint from you with a little body lean, but you literally are so sharp of mind that you wait for the keeper to make the move and then you decide you have to hit in the opposite direction.
Yeah, I never look at the ball. I don't look at the ball once. So,
wow. Yeah. Wow. Have you ever at any point, I think you've done 8 so far this season, all converted, you ever felt the slightest bit of nerves, not that confidence? And if the answer to this is no, what do you do to get yourself in that confident place?
To be fair, it wasn't that I wasn't confident. I think the first penalty against Millwall was a bit like, right, this is my chance to get going, get my goal and like get on the run. It wasn't not confident. It was a bit like nervous of it. A bit like, I need to get this. But then obviously once that gone in, the rest is just like, right, this is it now. I know my technique. I just got to concentrate on doing it well. And it's been paying off so far.
Yeah. And it's evolved, hasn't it? Because I was watching an old gold montage of you at Peterborough and you didn't used to take them that way. Well, the couple that I saw were much more firm a plant.
Well, yeah, though, obviously Peterborough, I didn't take the, that many because the chance I had, I missed. But that was against a former keeper that I used to play with, so he knows my technique, and if he waits late, then he's got a chance of saving it. But now I've kind of practiced and practiced. I always do it in training, after training. I think everyone gets annoyed at me quickly taking a penalty before we start sessions. But now I practice it quite a lot, and I feel like I've got the technique down to a T now.
So just to be clear, you're lining up with David Raya or Luke Dennis or whoever it is, and you're constantly trying to outfox them as well. And I should imagine that's quite frustrating from their point of view. Are they desperate to thwart you, aren't they?
Yeah, keepers hate it when they dive the wrong way. They get easy head loss, keepers nowadays, especially with that technique. It's just like, but yeah, no, they do get annoyed, but fair play to them for going and going and doing it. But
the questions about your penalty technique are over. You didn't give away enough to give the next opposition keeper any clue, so we're absolutely safe. Do you look at the goal scoring charts? You know, I gave you stats at the top of the piece there. Do you study them? Do you see where you are?
No, but my friends and family, they do keep an eye on that, and keep letting me know that I'm close to hitting the mark. I think it's the most in the championship, but my job is to get 3 points every game and do my job to help the team get over the line, really.
Yeah. So you can be Ivan Toney, close to breaking the all-time divisional scoring record, but with your 9 assists, it proves you can still be a team player as well. There's much more to your game than just scoring goals.
Yeah, 100%. I think if everyone's seen me play, they'll know that I'm not the typical greedy striker, if you want to put it like that. Like, there's chances. Like, if I'm 1-on-1 with a keeper and my mate's running up to support me to get a little tap in, I'm going to square it for him to put it in the back of the net, even though I back myself to put it in the goal myself. But it's just to make sure and kill the game off whenever it is and just get the extra goal. So I'm that kind of striker, and I feel like that's important to have in a team, especially with like Brentford as well, which everyone plays for each other and everyone helps each other and wants to do that extra yard for their mate to get over the line.
When did you become so comfortable in your own skin?
I think it was last year maybe the year before. Like, obviously I made the move from Newcastle to Peterborough. At the time in my career, I felt it was time to move on. Even though Newcastle's a massive club, they gave me my chance to progress in my career, but I felt like I wasn't getting the game time maybe it was so much wanted at Newcastle. So instead of going out on loan here, there and everywhere, I just wanted to be settled in one base and feel loved by the manager and a team that wants me and wanted to progress my career. And I felt when I first moved to Peterborough, that was my chance. Even though it took a few games to get going because I wasn't really getting in the team, the strikers were firing at the time, which obviously that's what you want competition in the team. But when I got my chance, I stayed in the team and I've done very well. I feel like obviously my season basically started in December, just after Christmas times, and I finished with like 19 goals in all competitions. So that's good. Then from there, I just haven't looked back. And the season after that, I think I got like 24 goals in the league. And the season was cut short in March times, just before end of February. So I feel like that's a good turnout again. And I've progressed even more now. I've passed that now into the championship. There was people doubting whether you can do it in the championship. But I always knew that I've got a good chance. I never thought I'd do this well, but I always knew I'd have a good chance in scoring a good fair amount of goals. And being in the Brentford side has helped me massively as well, because they create a lot of chances for a striker. And if you look over the years, the strikers have had, they've hit 20 plus. So it is a good thing. But the main objective for me and the team and everyone at the club is to get promoted and get into the Premier League.
I mean, it must be lovely to be Ivan Toney right now, to have exceeded your own expectations of yourself. Not only that, but to have had you move to Newcastle fairly young, to have had to regroup with your Barnsleys and your Shrewsburys and your Scunthorpes and your Wiggins, your kind of loan spells. So to be as hot as you are right now must just be the most amazing feeling, isn't it, Ivan?
Yeah, of course. Obviously, I'm proud of myself at this moment in time. Obviously, there's still more work to be done. But Yeah, I am really proud of myself. Obviously, I've set targets through the season and end of season goal on what I want to hit. And I've hit my target. I've had to change my target because I've done so well. And I think, why can't I go to this step, that step? And which is a good sign. You want to be doing that, setting new targets and targets you think, there's no way I'm going to achieve that. But then you're getting close to it and you think, hold on a second, I can actually hit that target. And to be doing that from when I was in League One, coming into the Championship, it was a bit like, it was a step up. It was a bit questionable. Can he do it? Can he not do it? And I've been doing it. So it is a good thing. It's proud. I'm proud of myself. My family are proud of me. My friends are proud of me. And even to the point where my teammates are proud of me and the manager brought me in and all the staff are proud of me because they knew what I was signing and they had trust in that I can do that.
So many things I want to ask you, but I want to strip it back to basics. Do you think strikers are born or made?
I think it's a bit of both. You see your natural strikers and you see your strikers that are like, oh, like Ollie Watkins wasn't really, I think he was a winger at one point. And then he converted to a striker and he's done unbelievable and he's doing unbelievable now. But I think there's a bit of both in there. You can make someone into a striker, given the striking mentality, or you can be born into wanting to score goals constantly. And so, yeah, it's a bit of a mixture.
What's the number one thing you are working on about yourself in training on a regular basis? What's the number one area of your game you're trying to improve?
Just being deadly in front of goal. When you get the chance and get in front of goal, just make sure it's going to hit the back of the net. So it's to the point where when I'm one-on-one, players know he's walk back to the centre circle and get ready because the ball's going in the back of the net. Them kind of things there and like deadly. When you get a chance, half a yard, finish. So I think that's the main thing I had to get into my game. And also creating, being clever in the box, like anticipating where the ball's going to go. And I feel like I've done that massively and it's helped me get to the 28 goal mark I'm at the moment, which is key as a striker if you want to be getting goals. Create space, not just for you as well, for others.
There's always been so much variety as well about your goal scoring, hasn't there? I mean, I think back to when I came to see you for a football focus piece at Peterborough, which must be about 18 months ago now. We were going through the old archives and found that absolute worldie you scored from the halfway line, you know. So you've always had that variety to your goals, left foot, right foot, head, way, way out, close at hand, one-on-one with a keeper. There's not too many strikers have that level of variety around their game.
Yeah, I think it's down to like quick thinking, whereas like other players might set up and just wait for the others to come and take the free kick, or it's just quick thinking really. If you see the keeper off, you try it. Like I nearly done it against Blackburn the other day. But ever since scoring from the halfway line, I've tried a few times and I get battered for it for trying it every time. But listen, you keep doing it, it's gonna pull off eventually, and you look the man.
Yeah. Do it for the sheer joy on my face when I see one go in the back of the net. Well, as long as it's not against Middlesbrough, obviously, in which case that would be a big problem. Let me be absolutely clear about that. I want to take you back with one question. When you go into Peterborough, who obviously nurtured you and really got you going and in the sort of pomp you're in now, do they actually use their previous strikers who have moved on? And it's a hell of a list, isn't it? Dwight Gayle, Britt Assambalonga, Connor Washington, whichever one you want to pick out, Jack Marriott. Do they actually go, come in, we'll get you going, score loads of goals for us. When the moment comes, we won't stand in your way when you want to move on. Is that part of the package when you go into a nursery environment like that, Ivan?
I think that does help. Yeah, that is the goal. They want, obviously, the people bringing you in want you to be doing well. And if a striker's doing well, scoring goals, you've got a great chance of winning games. Whereas, obviously, when I was deciding whether I was to Peterborough or not, it was kind of a no-brainer because you look at the strikers they've had before, they've all scored goals there and they've all done well. Whether if the club goes up and you go up with them, that's great. If they don't, then they know it's time to let you go on elsewhere and you've achieved your goal in League One, off you go. So that was a no-brainer when I was going to Peterborough. I checked the records and it was done. Likewise, when I come to Brentford, You check the strikers, they do well. If the club don't go up, then they let you go. So I think clubs know that it's time to let a player go and let him play in a higher division. And I think that helps the striker on making their decision and knowing that they're going to get goals for the team. Whereas you look at Clark Harris as well, he's done that for Peterborough. Like, I'm sure I would have been in his head when he was going into the club to say, oh, I haven't scored goals, done his job and he's got off. Whereas Britta Somalonga, he probably thought, I thought the same, and Jack Merritt and so on. So that does help the striker. Knowing the strikers before have goals, have gotten goals, and you're going to be footing them boots.
How did you cope with the first lockdown at this time last year? Because obviously you had scored a shed load, you were being linked with clubs. Then you end up in this limbo state of not knowing whether the league's restarting or not. But not only that, I'm guessing there was interest from Brentford, but you don't know at that point whether they're going up automatically, whether they're going to win the playoffs and hang on to the Ollie Watkins of this world. So I guess that, did that leave you in a strange sort of place of not quite knowing how the future was going to work out?
It kind of did, yeah. But at the end of the day, I'm still a Peterborough player. Well, I was still a Peterborough player, and I scored that many goals. It was just like, in my head, I had my head settled on, I have to go and do it again. There's no point dwelling on what could have been, was, ifs and buts, but I had the mindset as if to say, right, I scored 24 goals last year. Let's go and score 25. Let's go and get 26. And luckily enough, obviously Brentford was interested before the whole of lockdown, and they kept their interest come to the end of lockdown. So I think it was just like a waiting game, really. Whether that was in the Championship or Premiership, I felt like it was kind of a no-brainer on going to play the style of football Brentford play and get my chance here and play at a high level.
So how did the gaffer and how did the club deal with it when you all came back for pre-season training, getting over the disappointments of last season? Because you've obviously followed football for a while, you will know that sometimes when a team gets so close and don't make the promotion they're targeting, there can be hell of a hangover. So how did they deal with it and get you all going?
Well, here, I felt like it was, obviously it's going to be tough the way it happened. They could have got automatic. Then it was kind of like, oh, playoffs, we've got to go in. They lose it in the playoffs. It's never nice being knocked back like that. But listen, if you dwell on it too long, it's just going to hang over you. And it's just kind of like, it's not going to help in any situation. You can't change it. It's done. What's done is done. And I feel like the whole staff here and everybody involved was just like, last season's done. It's out the way. Let's focus on this season. We get promoted. We forget about last chance that we missed out on. That is key because everybody wants to do well. Yes, we want to be into Premier League, but you got to work hard for it. And everyone here works hard and has the strong mentality and wanting to win everything, even in training, little races, things here and there. And these little things help you to become the top team and want to get to where you want to get. So the dwelling on missing out and this and that, I don't think it's hovering around this football club, and I'm sure it'll be far away from here.
I know football clubs across the board are increasingly more and more multicultural, but I was looking through the list of nationalities and maybe I missed a couple off, but I got to 14 without having to break sweat. I mean, that's a lot of variety. So who sets the tone, the sort of culture of the club? Is it ingrained and then they tell you what it is? Is it something that you gradually learn? What happens that brings all these people from very different backgrounds together?
I think it's... Obviously, before I come here, I knew that there was loads of different backgrounds. And I've spoke to other players that's been here and they said, yeah, listen, there might be this person from here, this person from there, but we're all one big family. And that's the key thing about this club. No matter where you're from, pink, orange, black, white, doesn't matter what colour you are as well, we're all one big family. And that's good to have because you need that bond. There's no, like, people sitting here with their friends they've known for 10 years or a new player that's come in after 2 days. They'll bring them involved in the group and everyone's won. So that is good. And I can actually say Brentford's not a club like that to divide and single out certain people.
I mean, you must have learned so much from that situation just to be able to sit with Danes and learn from their upbringing or sit and learn, you know, across the board with, so as I say, with so many different nationalities, you must have, your own education of what goes on in the world must increase 20-fold, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's good. I think I'm fluent in Danish now, so it's good.
Go on then. Go on, give me I'm Ivan Tony, top goal scorer in Danish. I'm putting you on the spot now. Yeah. I thought you were winding me up.
Nah, yeah, it's great. It's a great club to be at. I feel like everyone's very welcoming. Everyone respects everybody. Even the people at the gate, to the cleaners, to the manager. We respect everyone the same way, and that's the key thing as a football club and in life, actually. No matter what you do, no matter how high you are, how low you are, you respect each other the same way, and that's good to have.
A couple of serious questions I want to ask you. One is, are you concerned about the amount of points you are dropping from leading positions? I think you're sitting on 18 at the moment. Is that something that you've had a chat about of late? Because it's happened to you in the last couple of games.
Well, yeah, obviously it's going to be something we look at. It's not the best situation to be in, obviously losing points when we're as solid as we are in crucial times. But like I said before, we can't change that. We have to focus on the next game and make sure it doesn't happen again. We are trying to cut out the errors that we're doing and be better at seeing games out and making it horrible for teams to break us down when we're winning. But it's one of them ones. It can happen to anyone. It happened to other teams throughout the season. But the main thing we could do is focus on ourselves and make sure it doesn't happen the next game.
You got a bit of that in your locker, though. I remember that lovely description from your gaffer when you won at Blackburn. It was a beautifully ugly win. And sometimes over the course of a successful season, you've got to have those, haven't you? The other thing is, you were one of the earliest teams collectively to stop taking the knee. What was the sort of course of events that led you to that point? Did you all collectively just think it had become wallpaper and maybe the early spontaneity effect had been lost?
Yeah, I felt like there was a time myself, I stepped forward and I said to her, well, I spoke to my dad for a long time, and I just felt like taking a knee, it was kind of losing its purpose, where we've been doing it for so long and nothing's really been happening. So I kind of brought that to the gaffer's attention, and I kind of felt like I spoke to him, and he was obviously on my side and said, listen, I'm all for it. If you feel like it's not strong enough to be taking the knee and it's not really sitting with the purpose that we're doing it for, then that all fair play, and we'll speak to the boys about it. And we all spoke together, and we all had the same idea, and felt like it was kind of losing its purpose. So as a group, we all thought, okay, we're going to stop doing it. Obviously, we still stand together on the actual thing behind it, but I think on this kind of topic, we can go here sat for hours and talking about it. But the main thing is, the people at the top, if they want to change it, they will change it. If they want to do something about it, they'll do something about it. We can sit here all day and say we should do this, that, and that. But we can say this, but the people that can change it or should change it, let's say. But whether they do or don't, it's another situation.
What does your dad say about the hideous racial criticism and insults that people keep getting on social media? I mean, do you chat a lot to your family and your teammates about this subject?
Yeah, all the time. Me and my family are close. We talk about everything, especially my dad as well. He calls me all the time. We talk all the time. He's like my best friend. But yeah, we speak on a topic about this. It's a hard one to get into, but the situations that go on, like, Everyone's hard behind a computer, messaging whatever they want to do, and just. But it's too easy nowadays. Way too easy.
Yeah.
People say whatever, just and be sat on their ass and just be doing whatever they want, and nothing happens with it.
I mean, on this exact podcast this time last week, the official EFL podcast, Curtis Davis was on, and we were chatting about the situation. He said, "What'll happen is there'll be an incident in the Man United game at the weekend, and whoever's the perpetrator of a mistake or something crucial will get this happening to them." And sure enough, you look at your headlines this morning and one of the boys has made a mistake. And I mean, you would think if it's as simple as one of us being able to spot that, that some sort of mechanisms could be put in place that could try and remove this heinous blight from society, let alone the game.
Yeah, of course. Obviously, off the pitch as well, it's just crazy. It's too crazy to think that people want to attack somebody's colour because they made a mistake. Like, it's football. You're going to make mistakes. And the fact that people want to abuse somebody by mentioning the colour of their skin or their nationality or whatever it is, it's crazy to think that people have that mindset and that mentality. But listen, some people in the world are built like that and feel like that's the right way. You can't really change it. You can't change their opinion on certain things. I can say the glass is half full. You're going to say it's half empty. Like, it's one of them things. But we can sit here all day and talk about it. But whether it changes or not, that's another thing. You just got to sometimes get on with life and try and deal with it the best you can, really.
Yeah. Well, keep fighting, all of you. Three quick questions to finish. I don't know if I've ever asked you this before, but I'm going to ask you again. Do I remember right, you did get the bus home after your debut for Northampton Town? Have I asked you that question before? It's just stuck in my head. It was you, wasn't it?
Yeah. I did. I got the bus home.
You literally just got, you came into the ground, got sort of put in the squad, ended up making your debut, and you had no, you know, there wasn't it. Was your old man not there to give you a lift home or anything like that?
I think he actually come to the game and we got back before him and all my family were buzzing at the time. I think they just kind of forgot about me and went home and just celebrating kind of thing. And then I actually think I got the bus for free as well because they recognized me and it was like, oh, you scored today, didn't you? And the bus driver was like, yeah, come on, we'll drop you back.
So, mate, don't get careful. There's probably some poor bus driver somewhere is going to get in trouble with his boss as a result of declaring that. Goodness gracious me. Number two is you're obviously ambitious. You're very ambitious.
Yeah, of course. You have to be.
But you see, what I mean is, you know, Ollie Watkins in your position this time last season suddenly gets a call up to the England squad. Who knows? The way you're going and the way you're ramming in the goals over the last couple of seasons, who knows what the future could hold for you? You're that kind of ambitious, not just the Premier League, but international aspirations as well?
Yeah, of course. Obviously, England or Jamaica, I play for both. But the main thing is just finishing the season very strong. Obviously, I want to be scoring loads of goals. I want to do the best I can for the team and get promotion. So hopefully I'll continue playing well, stay injury free. And that's the main thing. And whatever happens in the future happens.
And last question is, do you need to use the international break constructively from a rest point of view? Because it is a long, hard season. The games are coming thick and fast. Are you going to get a little bit of downtime, or is the gaffer going to keep you all on it continuously until you pick up with your next game, which is actually the Saturday, isn't it? Easter Saturday, 12:30 kickoff away at Huddersfield.
I feel like we are going to get some downtime and we are going to use it very wisely. I feel like the rest will do us some good because we've had loads of games in such a short period of time. And once we come back, I'm sure we'll be all raring to go and be excited to get back in with the boys and be training again. And I think it does help. It does help massively because you're not just refreshing the legs, you're mentally refreshed and prepared to go again and do the rest of the games, rest of the 9 or 10 games, whatever it is, when we get back and do the best we can.
Really lovely to see you. Thanks for sharing all that. It's been absolutely wonderful. I love watching you in action. I love your career path and the work you've put in to get yourself to this point. And it's one of the simple joys of English football at the moment is to see you take a penalty, with the caveat, don't score any in that way against Middlesbrough, please. Good to see you, mate.
And yourself. Thank you very much.
This is the official EFL podcast.
Brentford's Ivan Toney, surely destined for an even greater stage in the very near future. Simon Grayson is back in familiar territory, trying to help Fleetwood Town climb out of Sky Bet League One. He achieved promotion from that division with Blackpool in 2007, Leeds United in 2010, Huddersfield Town in 2012, and Preston North End in 2014. And obviously, Simon. Two of those promoted clubs, Blackpool and Preston, are geographically very close. Ribble Valley, Fylde Coast. So I've already had a bet on you being the next Morecambe manager when Derek Adams leaves. And also a couple of years down the line, I've got a little bet in as well that you're going to be moving to Barrow as well. Are you going to do the whole coast before you hang up your manager's notebook?
Well, Clem, I think Barrow's a little bit too far for me, to be fair. Morecambe, Fylde maybe, as I'm getting older down the divisions,
yes.
Possibly.
Yes.
No, it's just the way that it goes sometimes, isn't it? You get sort of where you're living, you sort of know the area, you know people that are running football clubs, like at Fleetwood now. I've known Andy Pilley since the early 2000s, when actually was a Blackpool boss, and we used to take the reserves to host, and Fleetwood hosted our reserve games there. So I got to know Andy quite well then, and remained in touch, and hence maybe why I got the job recently.
I mean, are there hesitations when you look at something like a Fleetwood Town situation, in so much as there's no doubt in the indomitable spirit of the owner and how far they want to go, but they have come a darned long way. So do you, as a manager going into a job, have to assess how much more stretch there is in them? Just what is realistic with the hand that you dealt?
I just think you look at many things. You look at the owner that you're working with. Does he give you time to implement your own ideas? Has it got good facilities? Well, both tick boxes straight away. Andy's a good man, a good football person. Training facilities are second to none. Where you can hopefully establish yourselves and build something, and who knows where it can end up. His ambition is to get into the Championship. And if I didn't think I could go and do that at Fleetwood, I wouldn't have gone there myself as well.
So here's a question. Because you said there was obviously a personal relationship going back, that you'd known him and chatted to him and stuff. Do you have a kind of chat along the lines of, look, let's give this a go, but let's make sure we stay friends if anything goes wrong? A bit like a husband and wife would if they were going to start working together or something like that. Do you have that kind of chat, or do you just assume everything's going to go okay?
Well, when I say know him, I don't know him that well.
All right, fair enough. Well, I don't want to suggest you were. I want you suggesting you were married to him, but you know what I mean. You know, if a relationship is quite tight and you've known each other for a long time, we know what the world of football management is like.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think when I said known him, our paths have crossed a lot. We haven't socialised or anything like that. It's there's a lot of respect for each other. You know, when you sometimes get a relationship when you go to another ground and you speak to people and you just instantly hit it off. So you can go probably a year, 18 months without speaking to somebody, and then all of a sudden you speak to them and you just have this relationship that you feel comfortable with, and that's where we are. So I think whatever happens in the future won't sort of damage any relationships that I'm going to have with Andy Pilley, as it hasn't done with Peter Ridsdale, Dean Hoyle and, Ken Bates to a certain degree.
I'll just leave that one hanging in the air there just for a few seconds to stretch it out. So you've had this kind of rare thing from your own point of view since you started in management in the mid-noughties, which is you've had a year out, part enforced by the pandemic, but I suppose it's been a weird sort of first two-thirds of the season for you to be watching it from the outside.
Yeah, I think when all this started, the pandemic last March, I was in Mumbai actually. I went to meet Martin Bain, who's the CEO at Sunderland. He's running the Indian Super League, and he said, "Look, after I'd left Blackpool, come out to Mumbai, get a life experience. Then we'll go on to Goa and watch the Indian Super League final." And I was away for 10 days, and it was actually just as the pandemic was just starting, first week in March, I think it was. So that was great to go and do that. And then obviously the lockdowns and the season ends in League One and below. And then you're just looking on and thinking, is football going to go back to any normality sooner than later? And as we all know, it still isn't back in that place where we all want it to be. And so I think when you're out of work, you're always, and you're desperate and you want to go back to work, you're always thinking, where's the next job going to be? What am I going to do? How am I going to get myself back into work? But I think in the back of my mind that the way football was going, that jobs weren't probably going to coming up anytime soon. People were just sticking with the present managers through financial constraints or just giving people extra time to see where the season goes or starts the following year. So I think it was just a strange time for everyone, and it just got to the point eventually, obviously, end of January that the call came knocking and the door came knocking for me, and it was basically go back to work.
Yeah, or some combination of those.
Some combination of those words.
Yeah.
Been a long time.
I know, mate. Is it getting harder and harder to find an opportunity where you do stand a chance, would you say? Do you think it's changed over the last decade and a half you've been in it?
Yeah, without a shadow of a doubt. I think I've said this over the last 2 years or so that I don't think I would like to have been a manager starting out now. Look, without a shadow of a doubt, when you're given the opportunities to do it and younger ex-players are coming through, starting their careers, they're going to take that opportunity. And what I mean is that you aren't given the time that we all got probably 10 years ago, 5 years ago, to overcome any difficult circumstances. I think I remember when I was at Blackpool and I got the job on the permanent basis that we won one in the first 10. And maybe you might not have survived that in this day, but that particular season, Carl Oyston stuck with me after them first 10 games and we still got promoted at the end of the season. And I think that's how football has changed dramatically in a short space of time, only over probably 2 or 3 years, where managers are getting 4 or 5 months and sometimes less than that to change the mindset and the philosophies around of a football club. And any manager will tell you, from the greats that have been in it a long, long time, time is of the essence, isn't it, really?
Yeah, except that I remember writing, I used to write a column for The Times, and I remember writing one, it was sort of semi-tongue-in-cheek, saying I could see in the future a situation where maybe a club had one game to go to either survive or to win promotion, and they might change their manager at that point because somebody stands a better chance of winning a game under pressure. I mean, I'm not saying we're at that extreme of it yet, but we're heading in that general direction, aren't we? Which I suppose leads me into a question that ties into my intro of you as to whether you have any worries about being stereotyped, because League One promotion is obviously it has become your party piece.
Yeah, look, and when I've been able to take teams into the Championship, I've been able to establish them and leave them in a better place. You go back to Preston, we had 2 years in the top, about, I think we were 11th in both them season, in budgets in the bottom three. Huddersfield survived and then ultimately got somewhere close. Well, we're in the Premier League a few years later. And obviously Leeds was 7th or 8th in the Championship when I left there, and obviously they've gone on to what they've achieved now. So look, it's just what you dealt with sometimes. Of course, I'd be like to be known as a Championship manager, been there for 15, 20 years and a Premier League manager, but sometimes you have to work your way through the divisions, and I'm more than happy to do that because I'm happy to work with people that I enjoy working with, and any success is great to have on your CVs.
Can you spot the characteristics that were inherent with the four promotions you did have? Does there have to be a certain set of things that have to happen? I mean, apart from the obvious, like winning football matches and enough points to finish at the top of the table. But, you know, is it attitude, momentum, values, beliefs? Are there certain characteristics you can spot across all four of them?
I think when you look at it, and you've mentioned a few already there, I think you've got to have a good dressing room, a good spirit, camaraderie about the players that you're working with. Hopefully they're enjoying and buying into the ideas that you're trying to teach them and encourage them to do on a daily basis on the training pitch, and then taking it into a match day situation. And my biggest philosophy is that make sure that players have no regrets after every game and every season that they've been involved in, and enjoy themselves. Life's too short to worry about if, buts and maybes. Well, go and do things. Go and express yourselves. And I think any players that have worked with me will realise that I'm a hard taskmaster, but I'm also a good person that they get on well with and enjoy working with, and don't feel under any real pressure, apart from the pressure that they're putting themselves under, but also to win football matches as well. Any extreme pressure is probably what I'm trying to say.
So that's a hell of a skill set from a manager's point of view, because you must feel pressure when it gets to those vital moments of the season, but trying to mask it and appear on the surface that you're laid back must be one of the key fundamental arts of management then, is it? If you want the sort of culture you've just described, Simon.
Well, I think if anybody who knows me and what I've been like as a manager will know that I don't get too high when you're winning games and don't get too low when we've lost games. I hurt, of course I do, and I get excited, but I don't show my emotions too much to people because it's just how I am as a person. And hopefully when the big games come around, the players can sense sort of that we're there to go and do a job, but also that if we don't do it, then nobody's going to really come down on them a ton of bricks, because it's pressure can lead to lots of different things and people can't handle it. And that's then understanding your players that you're working with and who needs a stick around the backside, who needs an arm around the shoulder, and what motivates the players. And all these things come into experience you get over the years, people that you've worked with when I was a player, but also people that I've worked with on the coaching staff who've worked with me as well.
Is the gear change from being out of work to in work quite different? And I don't just mean gear in terms of the clothes that you wear, because you can't wear your
collection on. I've got some collection now over the last few years of tracksuits from different clubs.
Well, I bet you have. But the gear I meant was the fact that, and Danny Cowley will be going through it over this week, having been at home and then suddenly managing Portsmouth. Nigel Adkins the same, suddenly getting the Charlton job. You're out of work. It's a bit more laid back, apart from the pressure you put on yourself. You get up when you want to. You don't have those routines. And then suddenly you're immersed in the world of football. Two games a week, absolutely flying. I mean, that first month must take a little bit of adjustment, does it?
I think when you're out of work, you're still constantly looking sort of through the internet, what players have gone in the transfer window, what are the results, are you going to games yourself if you can get to them? So you're still, football's never far away from you anywhere. But ultimately then you go back to work, and you go back to work because you want to do it. You can't go back to work thinking, oh, it's going to be quiet this week, we're going to have a nice easy time where we can just get back, ease myself back into work. You're going back because it's in your blood. It's the adrenaline that gets you there, and you want to be involved with players on the training pitch. You want to be involved on a Saturday, Tuesday, Saturday match day situation, feeling the butterflies. Is your team going to go and get a result? Are they going to put on a performance, or are you going to be sort of beat heavily, go on a losing run? It's just what I've been used to for nearly 35 years, Clem, since I joined Leeds as a 16-year-old now, and where I am, as a 51-year-old. So it's what you do. And if you don't want to do it and you don't want the hurly-burly and all the pressure of it, then go and do something else.
The mention of Leeds United there was absolutely perfect, because I do want to finish, if you don't mind, by just reflecting on the fact that Leeds all-time record goal scorer Peter Lorimer passed away at the age of 74 at the weekend. 238 goals, 705 appearances over two spells, two league titles, an FA Cup, a League Cup, what is now the Europa Leagues, represented Scotland in the 1974 World Cup. His second spell with Leeds, I think, might have coincided with your own spell as a trainee there.
I will have probably been a schoolboy rather than sort of him being on the books still. So I went in 86. Will it be a few years before that? He probably retired, I would think.
Okay. I was just wondering whether he'd lined up some of you kids as cannon fodder for his free kick practicing.
You
took the full sting of his shots. I mean, listen, where you would have got to know him in is his role as a club ambassador when you were manager of your own boyhood idols. I mean, what a man, what a legend to leave behind.
Yeah, it's so sad, isn't it? I think when you look at this past year, when you lose Peter, you lose Trevor Cherry, you lose Norman Hunter, you lose Jack Charlton, iconics, true, proper legends of football clubs that have played so many games for that particular club. And it is heartbreaking. I tell you something, though, there'll be some five-a-side team looking down on Leeds for the next rest of the season. But Peter was a great person. He was a great person to be around. Look, we had a few disagreements when he would write his column for the Yorkshire Evening Post on how the team were doing, but we'd resolve that with a glass of beer or a wine sometimes, and that's what it was all about. But he was an icon of our football club, and it's so sad when you know somebody so well and they leave us far too early.
Yeah. I mean, just when you think about people of a certain age, just that legendary Leeds team, so dominant in the Football League. And, you know, even down to things like the little sort of sock tags, do you remember, with the numbers on the on the socks and things like that? It's just, and the stylo and matchmaker boots that half of them used to wear. It was, they were the epitome of an era, were they not?
Oh, without a shadow of doubt. And we have contemplated, when I was a manager there, could we bring them sort of tie-ups back in? But it never got off the ground as such. Just to recognise what that particular group of players did for the football club. And it is so sad to lose them far too early. The greats and proper legends. And yeah, they might have had the odd club here and there, but predominantly to play for Leeds United, the number of appearances that they've had, the trophies that they've won, it's so sad, and they'll be forever remembered without a shadow of doubt.
I'm glad you managed to knock back a few little drinks with the great man while he was around. Good luck with another promotion push, Simon.
Cheers, Clem. Good to speak to you.
And while we are paying tribute to past masters, clubs across the country are also in mourning for the former Huddersfield Town, Leicester City, Bolton Wanderers, where he actually won the Golden Boot one season ahead of Kenny Dalglish, Birmingham City, Leeds United, Sunderland, Southampton, Brighton, Tranmere, Preston, and England striker Frank Worthington. He scored 266 goals in 882 career appearances and will be remembered as one of the game's true showmen.
This is the official EFL podcast.
Before we go, just time to mark your card on some of the other stories in Sky Bet League One. Since last we were with you, it was a winning start against Ipswich Town for the Cowley brothers, who've succeeded Kenny Jackett at Portsmouth on a short-term deal until the end of the season. Nigel Adkins, on the other hand, signed a 2.5-year contract to take over from Lee Bowyer at Charlton Athletic. He picked up a point in his first game in charge at Wimbledon, and Gillingham's creep towards the playoff continued with a draw at home to Doncaster Rovers. It's a slightly curtailed programme this coming weekend. Friday night, Lincoln travel to Oxford. Then Saturday, all 3 o'clock kickoff, Sunderland are at Bristol Rovers. It's Hull against informed Gillingham. Doncaster head to MK Dons. Peterborough entertain Accrington, and Portsmouth travel to Shrewsbury. In Sky Bet League 2, 7 points from 8 games led to Richie Wellens leaving Salford City just 5 months after his arrival. He left the club 6 points off the playoffs. Gary Bowyer takes over until the end of the season. Cambridge United won their top three clash with Forest Green Rovers, and it is now 10 wins in an unbeaten last 12 for Bolton Wanderers. There's a couple of really mouth-watering clashes this coming weekend in Sky Bet League 2. 12 o'clock kickoff sees Forest Green Rovers entertain Bolton. Cambridge head to Carlisle. Morecambe against Cheltenham is another top seven, all top seven clash, and Tranmere entertain Mansfield. That's it for another episode. A big thank you to Simon Grayson and to Ivan Tony. If you've enjoyed it, please do give us a 5-star rating, press the subscribe button, and share on your socials. If you'd like to get in touch, our email address is podcast@efl.com. That's podcast@efl.com. My name's Mark Clement. Thanks very much for listening. Join us again soon for another episode of
the official EFL podcast.